Our passage this morning, as I said, is 1 John chapter 3, verses 10 to 18. So our passage begins with a reference to two families. Verse 10 mentions on the one hand the children of God, and on the other hand the children of the devil. Two sharply distinguished families. It isn't the first time in the Bible that those two families have been mentioned in the same breath. For that, you have to go back almost to the beginning of the Bible, its very third chapter, Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, that famous verse that all of you will know, mentions two families. It refers to your offspring and her offspring. The speaker in Genesis 3:15 is God. He's addressing the devil, albeit the devil in the guise of a serpent. And so your offspring in that context are the children of the devil. Her offspring, that is Eve's offspring, are this other contrasting progeny. We can say they are the children of God. So I'm saying that's the first appearance of these two families in the Bible. And it's the most important appearance, because Genesis 3:15 is an announcement. It's an announcement that the two families are at war. There is enmity between them. The verse is saying, this is how the world is going to be from now on. It is going to be a war zone. It is going to be the scene of a great ongoing conflict between the children of the devil and the children of God. And John then, at the start of our passage this morning, wants to put us in mind of these two warring families. He wants to get them on our radars. Because in actual fact, the battle of the families overshadows the entirety of these nine verses that we're looking at this morning. In a sense, what John is doing here is this. He's giving a history lesson, a review of this conflict from its announcement there in Eden to his own day. More specifically, his approach is to zoom in on two moments in the conflict. That's what John does in this passage. He zooms in on two moments in this war between the families. Two strikes launched by the devil through his offspring. Let's take a look at each of them in turn. And first of all then, the strike that shows the basic model. That's our first heading, the strike that shows the basic model. So the first strike by the devil that John zooms in on is a very, very early one in the battle. The target of this strike is Abel, the son of Adam and Eve. It's the story found in Genesis chapter 4 that John has in mind. There in the Genesis account, what happens to Abel isn't described as a strike by the devil. The devil's not mentioned there, only what Cain did. Cain rose up against Abel, Genesis 4 verse 8. But of course it doesn't need to be spelt out, does it? The announcement of Genesis 3:15 has only just been made. It's still ringing in the ears. Every reader will automatically make the connection, viewing the Cain and Abel story through the lens of that announcement. But what doesn't need to be spelt out then in Genesis 4, John here does spell out. He makes it explicit that what happened to Abel was a strike by the devil. Cain, he says in verse 12, was of the evil one. He wasn't acting independently, in other words. He was an instrument. He was the channel through which the devil really was targeting Abel. And John then, as he talks about this, is interested in three strategies Satan uses as he targets Abel through Cain. Strategy number one, surprise. Surprise. Notice he doesn't actually refer to Abel by name in this passage. Rather, he describes him in a particular way as Cain's brother. Twice in verse 12, he does that. And he's highlighting then what a strange channel Cain is for this satanic strike. I mean, if you were an insurance company providing insurance for Abel, assessing the risks that he faced in his daily life, what would you be concerned about? Well, you'd be concerned about animals in this newly cursed world. Animals might attack Abel. You'd be concerned about those thorns and thistles and presumably other nasty things now growing out of the ground. Abel might eat something that he shouldn't eat. Those are the things that you'd designate as threats. Not Cain, not Abel's own flesh and blood, who lived under the same roof and ate at the same table. You wouldn't regard him as a danger to Abel. And yet he's the instrument that Satan uses. Not a wild beast, not a poisonous plant, Cain. You see what I mean? That surprise is one of the strategies John is highlighting. There's surprise involved as the devil launches this strike. Strategy number two, irritation. Irritation. How did the devil turn Cain against his brother? Did he take advantage of some vice in Abel's life? Some skeleton in Abel's cupboard? Did he make sure that Cain caught Abel in the act of doing something reprehensible? Committing some fraud or some sexual misdemeanor? No. No, it was quite the opposite, actually. It was Abel's righteous deeds that Satan took advantage of, John says in verse 12. His integrity and his wholesomeness and his trustworthiness, all the things that you would expect would compel Cain's admiration. But they didn't compel Cain's admiration. Instead, Abel's righteous deeds made Cain feel very keenly how evil his own were. And that exposure irritated him. It makes me think of a guy I used to overtake each day on my early morning run. He, I think, was walking to work. He wasn't running, he was walking to work. And I'll be as polite as I can about him. But let's just say that he wasn't in danger of being blown over by a puff of wind. He was a weighty guy. In fact, in order to go past him, I had to kind of veer onto the grass verge. There was no space left on the path. He filled the whole of it. And so I would do that then. I would just kind of go onto the grass verge and carry on running. And as far as I was concerned, it was no big deal. To him, however, something about this clearly was a big deal, because as I ran off into the distance, I would hear him shouting obscenities at me. The first time this happened, I thought maybe I'd just given him a fright. It was very early. It was dark. Perhaps this was his reaction to getting a shock. But after it had happened a few times, that explanation became less credible. I mean, he should have been expecting me by then. And in the end then, while I couldn't be 100% sure, I put it down to this. My running made him feel very keenly the unhealthiness of his own lifestyle, which was so clear to see. I suspect it was a little prod to his conscience regarding all the exercise that he wasn't doing. And he didn't like that prod. It irritated him and provoked him into this flurry of abuse. And that's Cain. John is saying. That's Cain. Cain is irritated by Abel's righteous deeds. That's Satan's strategy for turning him against his brother. So the surprise is irritation, and then strategy number three, murder. Murder. Irritated by Abel's righteous deeds, Cain murdered his brother, John says in verse 12. That was the extent. That was the severity of this strike by the devil. It left Abel murdered. So those are the three strategies: surprise, irritation, murder. But why is John interested in them? Why does it matter to him what strategy Satan used in that ancient strike on Abel? Well, this is why. As my heading indicates, the strike on Abel shows the basic model that Satan often employs. In that foray, way back at the dawn of history, he, as it were, sets the tone. He establishes there his mode of operation. And it's relevant to John, because as John views what's going on in the churches in his day, he perceives that same basic satanic approach. The Christians of Asia Minor at the end of the first century AD were experiencing a strike by the devil that essentially resembled the one in Genesis chapter 4. It featured the same three strategies. Number one, surprise. Now, here, understanding verse 13 is crucial. When John says there in verse 13, the world hates you, what kind of thing do you picture? Well, probably pagans and hostile authorities, that kind of thing. People out there looking at the church from afar and detesting it. But I don't think that's what John is talking about. For one thing, he begins the sentence, "Do not be surprised, brothers." Well, none of his readers are going to be surprised by pagans and hostile authorities hating them. That's inevitable. That just happens. John doesn't need to say, "Don't be surprised," if he's talking about hatred from people like that. For another thing, pagans and hostile authorities just don't seem to be on John's radar in this letter. In 1 Peter, they are a big theme. In James, they are a big theme. But not in 1 John. John isn't interested in enemies out there. And then most importantly of all, look at how he uses the world language in the early part of chapter 4. Verse 1, many false prophets have gone out into the world. Verse 5, they are from the world, these same false prophets. Therefore they speak from the world, and the world listens to them. These are the people that he talked about, you may remember, back in chapter 2, verse 19. I've said quite a bit about them already in this series. They had been members at one point of John's church, part of the Christian community. And I'm saying then that they are the haters in view in verse 13 here. They are the world. And you see then how, in getting at the first century Christians through those people, Satan was again using his surprise strategy. It's straight from the Genesis 4 playbook. You wouldn't expect Abel to be targeted by Cain of all people, and you wouldn't expect the first century church to be targeted by these people who were part of its very membership. So surprise. Number two, irritation. Why had these church members in the first century become so disaffected and so troublesome? Look at verse 14. We know that we have passed out of death into life because we love the brothers. You see, these people, they had seen the true Christians in the church practicing love, genuine love, forgiving each other and being patient with each other. And thinking the best of each other. And just as in Cain's experience, it had made them feel very keenly their own selfishness and mean-spiritedness. And they had become irritated by that. And then number three, murder. Ah, you say, well, this must be where the parallel with the Cain and Abel story breaks down, because these troublemakers in the first century church, they hadn't murdered anyone. Except that John says they had, actually. As they had been all difficult and unruly and divisive before eventually walking out of the church altogether, they had demonstrated hate. And everyone who hates his brother, John says in verse 15, is a murderer. Murder is hatred allowed to proceed to its logical conclusion. And hatred, therefore, is murder suppressed. Murder reigned in. So I hope you get all this then. In this great conflict that is going on between the children of the devil and the children of God, the devil has a basic model to which he returns constantly as he launches his strikes. It's the one that was on display right back in the second generation of human history. Satan was still making use of it in John's day, all those centuries later. And you know, he's still making use of it in our own day as well. Still today, the devil strikes at God's people, yes, of course, through governments and movements outside of the church, but also through Cains, through those on the inside, through professing Christians within the church who cause trouble and are quarrelsome and disruptive and speak and act in hateful ways. I think of a friend of mine in ministry who recently almost broke completely under the strain of these kinds of people in his church, a church just like ours, writing vitriolic letters, playing all kinds of political games. It has the evil one written all over it. It's how he's been operating since this war began. And I suppose the application for us here then is those four words at the beginning of verse 13. Do not be surprised. Do not be surprised. Do not be surprised when the world hates you, remembering that the world here is the world inside the church, not the world outside the church. Do not be surprised, because you do come across people sometimes who have observed this sort of thing going on in churches, and they've become disillusioned with Christianity because of it. As though hateful people emerging within Christian churches kind of fatally discredits Christianity itself and plunges the whole thing into doubt. Well, John says, no, it doesn't. It's exactly what you should expect. Because there's a war going on. And when it comes to launching his strikes, the enemy has a tried and tested model. He's been using it since this war began. You should expect modern day Cains in the church, irritated by the righteous deeds of true Christians in the church, and thus erupting in hateful speech and behavior. It's just classic Satan. It's what he does. And yes, certainly we should be saddened when we see it happening, but we shouldn't be surprised. And we shouldn't say, well, if this is happening, I'm done with Christianity. It happens. It has happened since Genesis 4. It will happen until Jesus Christ returns at the end of time. Now, I know this isn't a cheerful application, but it's an important application. Don't ever, I'm saying, don't ever be turned off Christianity by troublemakers emerging in the Church of Jesus Christ. Because in this war that we're in, that's inevitable. It's inevitable they will. It's inevitable that churches will go through what my friend's church has gone through, tragically. It's inevitable that these things will happen. And so pray that it won't happen. Weep when it does happen. But don't be put off Christianity because it happens. Because it's precisely what John says we should expect to happen. We're in a war, and this is how the enemy operates. But let's move on then to happier considerations. We've noticed the strike that shows the basic model. But secondly this morning, the strike that shifts the battle's momentum. The strike that shifts the battle's momentum. Because the other strike by the devil then, which John zooms in on our passage, is in verses 16 to 18, and it occurs several millennia later. And this time then, this strike by the devil, the target is not Abel. This time, the target is Jesus. And again, actually, the devil uses the same three strategies. Number one, surprise. In the strike on Jesus, he uses the Jewish chief priests and scribes and Pharisees. These men who knew the Old Testament so well. These men who ought to have been the ones welcoming Jesus more than anyone and posing the least threat of anybody to Jesus. And yet they were the ones, they were the Cains through whom Satan launched this strike on Jesus. Surprise. Number two, irritation. You see, it was Jesus' purity and Jesus' sincerity that exposed the hypocrisy and the insincerity of those religious leaders in Jerusalem and irritated them so much. It touched a raw nerve. They saw they weren't like him. They didn't have this moral beauty that he had, and it irritated them. Where they should have admired him and fallen down at his feet and said, wow, this must be the Son of God, instead, it irritated them. And then, of course, strategy number three, murder. As in the case of Abel, full-blown literal murder. Irritated by Jesus' righteous deeds, these religious leaders had him nailed to a cross. But this strike by the devil on Jesus, though bearing resemblances then to the one on Abel, ultimately, it's very, very different. The strike in Genesis 4 was a success. I mean, Satan could walk away from that feeling smug and feeling this war that's just begun, it's going rather well. I've already had one target and I've already wiped him out. It's all going swimmingly. Not so the strike on Jesus at Calvary. The strike by Satan on Jesus at Calvary was what we might call an overreach. You've perhaps come across that word. There was a book with that title, Overreach, that came out last year and won a whole array of awards. It was about Russia's invasion in Ukraine. And the title then, Overreach, reflects the author's opinion that this invasion has been an overreach by Putin. Ambition got the better of him, and he recklessly waded into an invasion that has taken him out of his depths. Now, whether or not that's right, whether or not Putin's invasion of Ukraine was an overreach, Satan's strike on Jesus at Calvary was certainly an overreach. He waded in to something that well and truly took him out of his depths. With this strike, actually, Satan threw everything away. He squandered his entire campaign with his strike on Jesus at Calvary. That's what I mean by my heading, the strike that shifts the battle's momentum. If you're into sport, you'll be familiar with the concept of momentum shifts. You get it in all sorts of sports, perhaps most conspicuously of all, in tennis. And you know how it is then, that in the men's game, a player can be two sets down and then struggling in the third set. And it looks like it's almost all over. But then suddenly there's a key moment. Suddenly he manages to break the opponent's serve. And that's it. There's a momentum shift. And he goes on to win that third set. And then he wins the next set. And then he wins the next decisive set. And the match is his. And when then Satan, through Jerusalem's religious leaders, launched that fierce strike on Jesus, far from being his greatest success yet, it represented a colossal momentum shift in the battle. In the language of Genesis 3:15, he delivered a nasty blow to Jesus' heel. But in the process, he received a vastly more devastating blow to his own head. How come? Well, because unlike Abel, Jesus wasn't caught out by this strike, a poor, helpless victim. No, he himself was in control of the devil's strike against him. He was using it to fulfill his plans and purposes. Satan intended the crucifixion of Jesus as the ultimate act of hatred that would drown the world forever in a sea of toxicity. But instead, he had to look on aghast as the world was flooded that day with a tidal wave of love. Jesus, in the language of verse 16, laying down his life for us to rescue millions of men and women and boys and girls from their guilt and from the hell that they deserve. And that tidal wave, John says, has continued to progress ever since that day, because God's love, verse 17 says, now abides in those men and women and boys and girls who have been rescued through Jesus laying down his life, so that they love each other. Indeed, and in truth, verse 18, what a thing that is. And I close then saying this morning. Let's make sure that tidal wave of love unleashed on Good Friday, the day that Satan hoped that hate would bring the world crashing down forever, Let's make sure that that tidal wave of love that has so confounded and appalled the devil, who thought that he was in the driving seat and securing the triumph of hatred, let's make sure that that tidal wave of love is surging through NREC. Not least in the form of generosity and sharing. If anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Perhaps in our prosperous context, it's more likely to be time and energy than material goods that we need to invest in each other. But whatever it looks like, let's have those open hearts that John talks about there, not closed hearts. Love triumphed at Calvary. The day Satan tried to swallow up everything in hate. Love triumphed at Calvary. May that be evident in this church. We're Calvary people. We're people of the crucified Jesus. May the tidal wave of love unleashed that day surge constantly through us. May we express it in a multitude of practical ways, in deed and truth, not just in specious talk. May we be people in whom the love unleashed on Calvary abides, in John's language. May we love each other faithfully, consistently, sacrificially, self-forgettingly, to the honor and glory of God's name. Amen.